Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On today's programme, the resignation of two of Britain's boldest Brexiteer plunges Theresa May's government into chaos. Pope Francis visits Ireland next month amid an increase in clerical child sex abuse allegations, and not everyone is happy about his visit.
So many victims and survivors feel very let down by the church authorities.
And we meet a young man from the African nation of Cameroon who is now in France creating his own fashion label. These stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. Britain's government is once again mired in crisis over the country's decision to leave the European Union. Hours after Prime Minister Theresa May's cabinet agreed on terms for a post-Brexit relationship with the rest of Europe, two of her most trusted ministers resigned. Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who campaigned vigorously for the country to quit the EU, had warned that Britain's new stance would reduce it to colony status. While Brexit Secretary David Davis, who led negotiations with Brussels, hit out at what he said was a watered-down version of Brexit. Nick Martin has more on another week of Brexit turmoil.
The Chequers compromise took 2 years to reach and just 2 days to unravel.
When British Prime Minister Theresa May told Parliament this week that her cabinet had finally come together after months of wrangling, she still faced a barrage of hostility from her political opponents, including Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn.
Mr Speaker, how can anyone have faith in the Prime Minister getting a good deal with 27 European Union governments when she can't even broker a deal within her own cabinet?
Although she claimed just a few days earlier that ministers had now agreed a unified position on Brexit, the resignations of two of the most hard-line Brexiteers, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson and Brexit Secretary David Davis, means a deep rift within her ruling Conservative Party is far from healed.
We do not agree about the best way of delivering our shared commitment to honour the result of the referendum.
But May was defiant as she told MPs how the government had agreed a workable compromise that would still deliver the kind of Brexit demanded by voters in the June 2016 referendum.
Mr Speaker, on Friday at Chequers, the Cabinet agreed a comprehensive and ambitious proposal that provides a responsible and credible basis for progressing negotiations with the EU towards a new relationship after we leave on the 29th of March next year. It is a proposal that will take back control of our borders, our money and our laws. But do so in a way that protects jobs, allows us to strike new trade deals through an independent trade policy, and keeps our people safe and our union together.
May's Brexit plan involves the creation of a new UK-EU free trade area for goods and more flexible rules for the trade in services, which in his resignation letter, Johnson described as a semi-Brexit. He said large parts of the UK economy would remain locked in the EU system with no control over how it was managed. The former Foreign Secretary said as this was Britain's opening bid in negotiations with Brussels, it meant the country would likely have to concede over two of the referendum's hot-button issues, immigration and the payments Britain makes to belong to the EU. David Charter, Berlin bureau chief for the Times of London, said Johnson's remarks that Britain was heading for the status of a colony was typical of his desire for a much harder Brexit, urging much looser links with the rest of Europe.
Boris is a wordsmith. He's made his living through journalism for the last 25 years. He's been a very powerful journalist, and he is trying to frame the debate. Again, the hard Brexiteers are trying to frame that narrow victory for leaving as a decision for the hardest possible Brexit. What Theresa May is saying is 48% of those who voted wanted to remain, so we should stay closer to the EU. than the hard Brexiteers want.
Following his resignation, rumours quickly resurfaced that Johnson would likely launch a leadership challenge to force May from office. The former London mayor, who led the campaign to persuade British voters to leave the EU, has regularly been mooted by his supporters as a potential next prime minister. Johnson would need the support of 48 Conservative MPs to trigger a no-confidence vote, which could take place quickly. But some political pundits believe he is unlikely to act until the autumn, where he could seek to seriously undermine advanced negotiations with Brussels. But despite having the support of several long-time Eurosceptic MPs, one of Johnson's former advisers described any leadership bid as being like an old boxer trying to get back in the ring when he shouldn't. Charter, meanwhile, thinks the two resignations will serve to embolden May's government and help to ensure a smooth transition out of the EU.
The events of the last few days make it less likely that we'll have a no-deal Brexit. Britain had to get a unified position for the talks on what the new relationship is going to be between Britain and the EU. If Theresa May really has resolved that tension, if the cabinet is united, then she has the mandate to go for this particular deal. I think this will be looked on in history, actually, as the moment Theresa May proved her mettle.
And that will be vital, not only politically, but economically, as the British leader faces renewed pressure from the business community, which has grown impatient over the government's internal squabbles and has threatened to pull investments from the country. So far, business leaders have welcomed a more clear direction from the government. And Brussels, which until now has urged Britain to put its Brexit proposals on the table, has cautiously welcomed the Chequers deal. EU negotiator Michel Barnier now says he believes a full agreement can be struck before the October deadline. That is, unless Brexiteers regroup and once again come out fighting. Nick Martin, DW.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe. Now, Britain has less than 9 months to organise its place in the world outside the EU. In the meantime, as we've been hearing, Theresa May is struggling to keep her government together, and a very important vote on trade policy is just around the corner. I'm joined by Adriano Bassoni, senior Europe analyst at geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor.com. Hello.
Hello.
How will Brexit play out in the 9 months before the date it's due to leave the bloc, which is March 29th next year?
The next 8 months will be crucial because there will be lots of summits and meetings and last-minute decisions to be made. As you said, on July the 16th and the 17th, there's this important vote on the future of Britain's membership in the customs union. This is a big decision that the British Parliament has to make. Then in October, we have the big EU summit in which, in theory, there should be an agreement about the withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the European Union. But if they do not reach an agreement, and that's quite likely, there could be an emergency summit in November. And we know that probably the last possible date for an agreement is December, the last European Council of the year. In theory, if everything goes well, at some point between January and February, there should be a ratification of whatever deal is reached, both at the House of Commons and then by the EU member states.
Mm-hmm. I mean, time is getting very tight already. I mean, just during the week, the French finance minister said time is extremely low for Britain to reach an agreement. If they leave it till December, this is really tight.
It's extremely tight. And we have to keep in mind that Prime Minister Theresa May is fighting on two fronts. She thought that the main threat were the softliners in her party, which wanted the UK to remain in the customs union and the single markets. But now she has realized that the hardliners are a problem as well, because they are threatening to challenge her leadership. They are threatening to veto whatever she sends to Parliament, both Brexit-related and non-Brexit-related. So she will be fighting both to reach an agreement that the Parliament can approve and to survive as British Prime Minister.
What's the final deal going to look like?
There are basically three options. I think the chances of a no-deal situation are there. They cannot be ruled out, especially because they are still struggling to reach an agreement on the future of Northern Ireland. If this happens, then the UK and the EU will negotiate, will trade under WTO terms. Tariffs will be imposed, customs checks will be imposed. But I think that even if we reach a no-deal scenario, that would only be temporary, because at some point, the negotiations over a free trade agreement would start. Even if there is not an agreement by the end of the year, it would only be temporary, because at the end of the day, they want a free trade agreement. So that's scenario one. Scenario two is for the UK to remain in the customs union or to convince the European Union to accept this proposal of remaining in the single market only for goods. In either of these scenarios, the services sector would face significant challenges, because neither of these scenarios involves an agreement on the financial services. And the third scenario, which we cannot rule out, is that by the end of the year, they decide that this is an impossible situation and they vote on an extension of the Article 50 negotiations. Let's keep in mind that this can happen if the European Union members unanimously support a continuation of the negotiations, then they can extend them. So I would not rule out that either.
And how long would it be extended for?
It could be another year, it could be another 2 years. The treaties do not specify the length of the extension. They only say that if there is unanimity and the 28 members, or in this case the 27 members, vote for it, there could be an exemption. I do not rule this out, because this is such a chaotic situation and nobody really knows what's going to happen.
Absolutely, yeah. And the customs union, if they were to stay in the customs union, that would go against what the British people voted for, because they voted to leave the customs union and the single market.
That's interesting, because the British voters only voted to leave the European Union, but they did not tell their leaders how to do it. So a point could be made that the main issue was immigration, for instance, and not trade. So nobody really knows what the British voters voted for. They just want to leave. They just told their leaders to leave the European Union, but they did not vote on the terms of the exit. And that's why Labour and some softliners in the Conservative Party, they are saying that they should remain in the customs union. The main issue with the customs union is that if you remain in the customs union, you end up in a situation similar to Turkey, which has to accept every single free trade agreement that the European Union signs with other countries or blocs, but they cannot have an independent trade policy. So the United Kingdom would be surrendering the independence of its trade policy, which is unacceptable for hardliners like Boris Johnson or David Davis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting times. Adriano Bassoni, Senior Europe Analyst at Stratfor.com. Thank you for joining us on Inside Europe.
Thank you very much.
I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Next month, Pope Francis will visit Ireland in the first papal visit to the country in almost 40 years. But the country that threw open its arms for John Paul II is very different to the one that will host Pope Francis, and not everyone is happy he's visiting. Sean Defoe reports from Dublin.
Young people of Ireland, I love you.
Pope John Paul II addressing a youth mass in Galway almost 40 years ago. That was the first time a pontiff had visited Ireland, and over the three-day visit, 2.7 million people turned out to see him, half the population of the island at the time. But those crowds are not expected again when Pope Francis visits this August. Half a million tickets have been handed out for a special mass in Dublin's Phoenix Park, half the number that turned out for the same event in 1979. While many welcome the visit, some members of Parliament think the church has questions to answer.
Do you propose to raise the fact that so many victims and survivors feel very let down by the church authorities?
I think the ones that would matter most to people who feel they have been hurt by the church and its role in clerical sex abuse, in the adoption scandals that we're dealing with, and so on, but particularly in the area of clerical abuse, is to request of the Pope that the Vatican files on what it knew, when it knew, and what it did about reports of clerical sex abuse, I think is terribly important.
In protest of the visit, a group called Say Nope to the Pope have tried to acquire as many tickets as possible for the Mass to make it look as though the turnout is much less than expected. One man booked 700 tickets for himself with the intention of burning them. The group says it's never encouraged people to block book tickets just to exercise their right to peaceful protest. But Prime Minister Leo Varadkar says it's not a valid form of protesting the visit.
I firmly believe that such actions, if they're happening, are wrong and petty and mean-spirited. Protest is legitimate, protest is okay, but denying other people the opportunity to attend a Mass or attend an event is not legitimate protest in my view, and is very unfair.
The Taoiseach, which is Irish for Prime Minister, says he'll raise the issue of historic clerical abuse with the Pope.
I will use the opportunity to welcome him to Ireland on behalf of the Irish people, and I think he will be very welcome in Ireland, and also to use the opportunity, yes, to raise issues of historic abuse against our citizens by church authorities, and I think people would expect me to raise them at such a meeting.
While other members of his cabinet want to see more reform in the church, Culture Minister Josepha Madigan recently caused an unholy row after stepping in to save parts of a Mass when a priest didn't show up.
It wasn't my fault that there wasn't a priest available. It's just the circumstances happened. I was asked to comment on it, and I have. And I think it would be wrong of me not to take the opportunity to highlight the inequalities that I see in the church when I do attend church. And that really is the fact that there is an inequality in relation to women. I think I see older girls there. I don't see women priests. I think that's something that needs to be addressed into the future.
Her intervention led to criticism from the Archbishop of Dublin, who said Minister Madigan's calls for female priests were disrespectful. That's the sound of journalists singing to Pope John Paul II in 1979, perhaps showing best the very different relationship that Ireland had with religion 40 years ago. The Catholic Church had a massive influence on society. Homosexuality was illegal, divorce was illegal, abortion was illegal, even contraception was illegal. A fear of being shunned by society because of the doctrine of the Catholic Church led to the mother and baby homes, to children being illegally sold or put up for adoption, and of course sexual abuse within the church, blights on Irish history that are still now only fully coming to light. Hundreds of thousands of people will still turn out to see the Pontiff next month and celebrate their faith, but it'll be far different to the celebrations seen across the country the last time a Pope came to Ireland.
Sean Defoe reporting from Dublin. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Nixon, Joyce is a face and perhaps a six-pack you may recognise here in Europe. He's modelled boxer shorts for David Beckham and Calvin Klein. He lives in Paris, a pretty different world from the one he grew up in before leaving Cameroon for France's capital city as a teenager. But he's planning to reunite the past with the present through his passion for fashion. Danny Mitzman went to hear his story backstage at a fashion show during his recent modelling assignment in Italy.
Nixon Yannick Mpek goes by the name Nixon Joris for his work. He's modelled in Paris, London, Switzerland, and today he's on the catwalk in Italy's fashion capital, Milan.
I wasn't born in Paris. I was born in Cameroon, in a small town called Seka, about an hour away from the capital, Yaoundé. I moved to France when I was 15. My father sent me away because he wanted a better future for me. He thought it would be easier to earn a living in France because it's really tough in Cameroon. Where I come from in Cameroon, it was really hard to get work in anything from architecture or law to anything else. I know loads of people who've left because of this. Whether you've got a degree or not, there are few opportunities. We won!
Oh! par le football qui est une passion nationale du Cameroun.
Football is our national passion, but not everyone can become a top footballer. Unfortunately, if you want to get a job, it's all about who you know. My father understood this very quickly, and that's why he sent me to France.
But Nixon's initial choice for his new life in Europe didn't quite live up to his father's expectations.
Donc avant j'étais footballeur, je jouais en Suisse, en deuxième ligue suisse.
I used to play football for a Swiss team, but my dad wasn't happy about it. Like all parents, he wanted me to concentrate on school and studying, so I gave it up.
Dès que j'ai eu mon bac, j'ai commencé dans le mannequinat. Donc j'ai été repéré par un...
As soon as I got my school leaving certificate, I started working in fashion, initially as a model. I was spotted by an Italian agent from Rome who was in Paris looking for young models. He was a young designer who needed catwalk models. I said, no problem. That's how I began my first experience in fashion.
In spite of his father's initial worries, Nixon's carved himself a successful modeling career in Europe, including his first time on the catwalk at Milan Fashion Week this year. Nixon's now 23, and although he enjoys modeling, he has other plans for his fashion future, which involve combining his European present with his African roots.
Fashion's really at a standstill in Cameroon, and that's why I have projects there. I want to set up a modeling agency in Cameroon, and I'm creating my own clothing label. I really want to try to modernize fashion in my own country, and I think my experience here in Europe can bring something to African, especially Cameroonian fashion. African fashion is much more concentrated on Letusu wax, traditional African fabrics. There aren't any mixes. My creations will be chic classy, London style, with a mix of materials, some wax here, some cotton there, a touch of extravagance. I think it will be great for African fashion.
Nixon plans to launch his first collection for men and women this summer. There'll be coats, polo shirts, shorts, swimsuits, even women's lingerie. He's given his brand the curious name Overti Lion, and there's an equally curious story behind it.
When I decided to start this project, I had a dream. My dream was that people were applauding me. I was a model, and when I got on the podium, everyone clapped. When I woke up, I said the word poverty. I don't know what it means. Perhaps it was a sign from my late mother. I have no idea, but I really liked it. Then I reflected on the fact that it shouldn't be simple, so needed a second part. Why the lion? Because the mascot of Cameroon is the lion. So I said to myself that I wanted to distinguish myself by having a modern European name, and at the same time, a name that would identify me as being from Cameroon.
Nixon says he's already got potential European and Cameroonian customers waiting for his creations to come out. But what does his most important critic think?
My father is supporting me because he understands that we are not all made for going to school and for working in offices. To each his own, as they say. My father's always liked artistic things. He dresses really well and loves clothing. So he'll be the first to wear my creations, and he can't wait for them to come out.
Danny Mitzman with that report from Italy. This is Inside Europe. If you'd like to contact the show, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is europe@dw.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on SoundCloud and iTunes. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the next half an hour, Greece's economy is back on track, but a brain drain is sucking the hope out of Greece's future generation. The EU's most corrupt country, Romania, fires its chief anti-corruption prosecutor.
I'm extremely worried. We are just one step away from being another Hungary or another Poland, an illiberal state governed by criminal political networks.
Protestant Orange men in Northern Ireland celebrate the 12th of July by marching through Catholic areas. Culture or provocation? And as Spain opens its eastern ports to NGO rescue ships in the Mediterranean, many migrants who have reached the north of Spain are desperate to escape. Stay tuned for these stories and more. Hundreds of thousands of refugees arrived in Germany in 2015, and many have struggled to integrate. It takes about 7 years for new arrivals to learn the language, settle in, and find work. But one startup in Berlin is hoping to speed up this process. They have IT courses in coding and web development for refugees to improve their chances of finding a stable job. Our reporter Tony Andrews has this story.
Welcome again for everyone. Happy to be with you today.
I'm in Berlin, Germany, at an organization called Ready School, an initiative that seeks to help refugees integrate into the German job market. An auditorium full of about 80 people is filled with friends and family members of the course graduates. They're all proud to see their loved ones complete one of the courses available here in programming or web development.
Okay, so Ready has two programs.
Ready School has been celebrated as a catalyst for integrating the over 600,000 refugees in the country who are currently of working age and need a job. Chancellor Angela Merkel has even come to visit the institution because of its remarkable results. The Ready School has managed to reduce the time it normally takes a refugee to find work, which on average is between 5 and 7 years. I'm here to speak to some of their graduates.
My name is Omar Al-Sabbar. I'm from Syria, Aleppo.
Omar has been in Germany for 2.5 years. Though he had just graduated with a degree in computer programming from a Syrian university in 2015, he had little hope of finding a job here once he arrived.
Actually, it seemed very difficult to have a work in Berlin because I couldn't speak German at all.
He found out about the school through a Facebook post and decided to sign up for a free course in a programming language that he had been unfamiliar with, Ruby on Rails.
If you go to classes at Ready School, you meet regularly people from Germany who want actually to help somehow. They were looking for a programmer, and I got suggested.
Omar got the job and was both overjoyed and incredibly daunted.
The first day at work was like, oh, everything is new. Everything, like the rules, the German style at work, everything 100% new. Was like going to back home with a full head.
But he soon got used to the environment. He worked there for 1.5 years and has since started his master's degree at Berlin's Technical University. Omar says he's really started to feel at home in Germany.
Nowadays, I speak the most of time in German. I also speak sometimes German at home, although my wife came from Syria as well, but we enjoy practicing German. So
for Omar, finding work in Germany has significance beyond the financial benefit for him and his family.
Working in Germany is something we have to do. I feel like it's like a duty. We came here, we got support from the community, from people. We had loads of open arms, and now we have also to do something in return. At least to help the other Syrian refugees, and in the same time to support the community.
Since the Ready School started in 2015, over 600 students have gone through various courses. 50% of them have ended up in jobs, paid internships, or some kind of study program.
Ready is not only about giving them an opportunity to work, but also creating hope and creating great synergies in our community.
That's Manuel Laudem, a program manager at the school. Though the institution benefits new arrivals to Germany, companies benefit too. The German IT industry currently has 55,000 specialized jobs it needs to fill. The idea for the school arose from the ambition to connect these companies with job seekers and volunteers. Well, that's what the Ready School calls IT professionals who offer their time to teach.
So we talked to the students, and we talked to volunteers, we talked to companies, and we saw a great potential for synergy there. So that's when we came up with ideas for courses.
The level of time commitment varies depending on what the volunteer teacher has available.
Usually there are two teachers for every lesson. A lesson is about 2 hours, and usually it's every course is taught twice a week in the evening, because most of our students have language courses, integration classes, or even internships or study programs during the day.
But not all graduates necessarily go on to work in the IT industry.
So my name is Fadi Zaim. I'm from Syria.
Fadi was part of the school's very first cohort.
Since we started the school, I was always saying the Syrian food is the best food and it's very tasty.
For his course graduation, he remembers presenting an online shop selling Syrian food. It was just a mock-up, meant to demonstrate his programming skills. But surprisingly, one of the attendees thought it was a real shop and later came up to him saying,
"Next month we have 2 workshops and we would like to order from you. So please send me your offer and your flyers." I was, "What? I have literally no offers, no flyers, nothing. I was going only to present what we were working on."
Fadi scrambled together family and friends to try to conjure this catering business out of thin air.
And for luck, my cousin is a professional on Photoshop. So I took the photo. My sister is studying dentistry, as I mentioned here. So she speaks the best German in the family. So she wrote the text. My cousin developed the flyers. I checked other catering companies how to make a flyer, how to make an offer.
They managed to create everything. Logos, photographs, and signage, all within 3 days. Eventually, they catered for the workshop and have done so for many high-profile clients.
We catered for Mrs. Merkel when she visits here. We catered for Facebook, for Zalando, Deutsche Bahn, Deutsche Telekom, Cisco, McKinsey, very big names. So we had a quite good reference, and also on our Facebook page we have a good reviews.
Fadi is also doing the catering for the event happening today. He says he's pleased to help out the school because of what it's done for him, but also because of what it represents to the general public.
Because when you look in the media, you think only people uneducated and people that crossing borders, jumping, and so it is the situation like that. But on the other hand, these people, there are very much lots of talented people, people with skills, educated people, and that's what the school is showing.
For DW in Berlin, Germany, I'm Tony Andrews.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe. The EU's most corrupt state is Romania, where authorities have been fighting against endemic corruption for decades. Earlier this week, the country's chief anti-corruption prosecutor was fired. Her dismissal is raising concerns both within the country and among its allies. From Bucharest, Kit Gillett reports.
After weeks of will he, won't he, on Monday, Romanian President Klaus Iohannis finally announced the dismissal of the country's chief anti-corruption prosecutor, Laura Codruța Kövesi. While the official statement from his office made it clear that he was acting on the orders of the Constitutional Court, the result was the same. Kövesi, who has been in office since 2013 and has led the charge against high-level corruption in Romania in recent years, was out. For many in Romania, Kövesi has become a symbol of the country's fight against corruption, which has netted thousands of convictions and earned praise from Brussels and further afield. However, she has also become a target for those who feel that anti-corruption efforts have gone too far and are politically motivated. In February, the country's justice minister accused Kövesi of overstepping her authority and recommended her dismissal. The president, who hails from one of the opposition parties, refused to act, but the country's constitutional court ruled in late May that he was unable to block the decision. In a state governed by the rule of law, decisions of the constitutional court must be respected, Iohannis' office said in a statement announcing Kövesi's dismissal, adding that the country's fight against corruption will not stop. Kövesi's firing was greeted with concern by those fearful that Romania, which joined the EU in 2007, is backsliding on its anti-corruption efforts. People like Mihai Politianu, one of the founders of Initiativa Romania, a civil society group that has been prominent in anti-government protests over the last year and a half.
I feel depressed, worried and furious. I think it is a major defeat for the democratic forces in front of the illiberal and the criminal political networks that control the Romanian government.
Surrounded by her staff, Kövesi struck a defiant tone in her farewell press conference, accepting the president's decision while highlighting the achievements and continued importance of the anti-corruption agency, known by its initials DNA.
DNA a demonstrat că legea este egală pentru toți.
DNA has proved that the law is equal for everybody and that nobody is too strong to evade the law. Independent prosecutors have conducted investigations against people who seemed untouchable, regardless of their positions or wealth. After 6 years as General Prosecutor of Romania and 5 years, 1 month and 24 days as head of DNA, I can tell you that nothing is as important as continuing this fight, because it is a fight to defend society from dangerous criminals.
Kövesi's departure comes at a fragile time for rule of law in the country, with Romania's parliament pushing through changes to the criminal code, overhauling abuse of power laws by lowering sentences and requiring prosecutors to prove that defendants abused power for their own benefit or that of a close relative. The European Commission has come out and said it is following developments closely and won't hesitate to act if necessary. Meanwhile, the powerful leader of Romania's governing Social Democratic Party, Liviu Dragnea, was sentenced to 3.5 years in jail for abuse of office in late June, a verdict he is likely to appeal. Going forward, a lot may ride on who comes in to replace Kövesi and what signal that sends to the population and Romania's allies.
If a chief prosecutor is politically obedient and wants to stop the criminal investigations against high-level corruption, he has the means to do so. It is that simple.
According to Mihai Politianu, Romanians don't need to look far to see where their country could be heading if it backslides on anti-corruption efforts.
I'm extremely worried. We are one step away from being another Hungary or another Poland, an illiberal state governed by criminal political networks.
Kit Gillett for DW in Bucharest, Romania.
You're listening to Inside Europe. In recent months, many migrants have been using Spain as a stepping stone to the UK, particularly since that migrant camp in northern France, known as the Jungle, was dismantled in 2016. Bilbao, on Spain's northern coast, has a regular ferry service to England. Migrants, especially Albanians, try to stow away on vehicles about to board these ferries. Ferry companies can face hefty fines if the British authorities find that migrants have managed to get across. Guy Hedgecoe reports from Bilbao.
It's early morning at Bilbao port, and two civil guards stop and check a lorry that's about to board a ferry heading for the British city of Portsmouth. They're searching for stowaways. Last year, they managed to stop 4,000 attempts by migrants to board lorries, trucks and caravans here. One of the civil guards on duty explains the procedure.
Yeah, the process is that we check every truck that is heading to the UK, and we check the underneath of every truck, and we go into the truck, and apart from using a device to get a good level of CO2.
So if there's too much CO2 in the vehicle, then you suspect there might be somebody hiding in there?
Yeah, well, that's what we do. Every time that the level is too high, we open the truck and check, because normally there is people inside.
Does it worry you that there are so many migrants hiding, sometimes dangerously?
Yeah, for example, last week we found a guy inside a box, and the box was totally packed, totally closed, and he couldn't even breathe. So we have to take him out, and he was about to fall down. Sometimes hiding even underneath the trucks, they can't be run over by the trucks. So they are putting their lives in danger.
Vale, limpio. Dale!
This check has been negative, so there are no stowaways on board this vehicle. But I'm told that a total of 11 stowaways have been caught already today. 10 of those were Albanians, and one of them was a Moroccan man who was balanced on the axle underneath a lorry which was about to get onto the ferry. If I look inland to the hills behind, halfway up one of those hills, I can see a number of tents, and the civil guards here have told me that in those tents there are migrants who are camping out, and they're waiting for their moment to jump onto a vehicle that's heading for Britain. Many of the truck drivers here are used to the migrants trying to get into their vehicles.
We're constantly seeing immigrants trying to get on and in the trucks as well. They pick the locks and they get in overnight normally. We get here on a Monday evening. A lot of the trucks have decided not to come in no more because of the amount of immigrants that there is here.
Most of the migrants here are Albanian. Social deprivation and high unemployment in their country has encouraged young men to leave and seek work elsewhere. Violent feuds between Albanian clans are also seen as a factor driving emigration. One young Albanian I meet, called Arben, has been living in a tent here for 7 months, trying to stow away every single day, but always getting caught. He believes the UK, with its low unemployment rate and relatively high wages, offers a better life.
In Albania, no have nothing, no have working, no have money, nothing. And I send my family a little bit money for eating, and I need to go in England.
It sounds quite dangerous.
Yes, dangerous, just it is no have work, no have life, no have money, nothing. England have work, have everything.
According to Spanish law, stowing away is classed as an infraction rather than a crime. So when the civil guard find migrants hidden away in vehicles, they're usually taken out of the ferry terminal area and released without charge. Most of the thousands of stowaway attempts here in recent months are believed to have been carried out by just a few dozen migrants who make repeated efforts to get across, most of which fail. A group of local volunteers has been helping migrants like Arben. Merce Puig is one of them.
We have been for a year working with the people that live around the port. We try to make their lives not so bad, because to live in a tent are very bad conditions here. The weather is very bad, it's rainy, it's cold. When they come, they normally they don't have tents, they have nothing, just the clothes and their phones, just to be in touch with their families.
Merce says that her organisation, Ongi Etori Errefuxiatuak, is doing a job the local authorities should be doing.
When we start working with them, we think it was just for a few months, just till the city halls or the governments know about it, know about the problem, and they will give some solution for these problems. But the governments, they didn't help them.
The Spanish authorities have built a 4-metre-high wall around the ferry terminal car park, and they have increased security around the port. As a result, the number of migrants trying to get through here has dropped recently. But perhaps inevitably, they are now going to other ports, like Santander, further along the Spanish coast, to try their luck there, however dangerous or difficult it may be. Guy Hedgeco, DW, Bilbao.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. This is Inside Europe. 20 years after the Good Friday Agreement changed the political landscape of Northern Ireland, Protestant and Catholic communities are still largely divided, particularly in working-class areas. Tensions can flare easily, especially around the 12th of July. That's when Protestant Orange men and some women celebrate the victory of the Protestant King William of Orange, who defeated Catholic King James at the Battle of the Boyne in July 1690. the Orange Order, a Protestant fraternity, marches through the streets of the capital Belfast and other towns with flute bands, often through Catholic areas. The Orange men say it's their culture, but Catholics argue that some of their behaviour is provocative. Louise Osborne has this report from Belfast.
The high shrill tones of a dozen flutes clash as the players tune up their instruments. Music sheets balance on stands in front of the musicians as they scrape back their chairs and take a seat at the front of the dark room. The walls are decorated with Union Jack flags and red, white and blue bunting hangs from the ceiling. These are not what you might think of as typical flute players. Dressed in jeans and football jerseys, tattoos peeking out from under their short sleeves, middle-aged men press their weathered fingers to the instrument holes. Others standing behind the flute players beat rhythmically on drums hanging from their necks. These are the Shankill Road Defenders, a military-style flute and drum band based in Belfast's notorious loyalist stronghold, Shankill Road. Today is their last practice before they march with hundreds of other loyalist bands in the Orange Order parades.
It's just tradition, you know, and the only way I could compare it would be like a royal family, the way the royal family continues their traditions. Even with the Roman Catholic Church, you know, the Pope has his address on Easter Monday or Easter Sunday. It's just tradition, and it's something that we have.
Sam Bailey began playing with the Defenders when he was 17 years old, at the height of the conflict in Northern Ireland. It pitted loyalists, mostly Protestants dedicated to Northern Ireland remaining part of the United Kingdom, against mostly Catholic nationalists, who wanted to see the country united with the Republic of Ireland. Terrorist paramilitary groups like the pro-nationalist Irish Republican Army, better known as the IRA, and the Loyalist Ulster Defence Association, or the UDA, waged a guerrilla war known as the Troubles from the late 1960s until a peace agreement was signed between the main parties in 1998. During the Troubles, Loyalist bands like the Shankill Road Defenders helped keep boys off the streets, says Sam.
He had the band, and that sort of kept us indoors. Them used to practice twice a week sometimes, you know, and same when they were riding out the streets, you had always us to fall back on, you know.
But that's not how everyone sees it. Some flute bands have been linked with loyalist paramilitary organisations and are also viewed negatively because of their sectarian music and behaviour during the parades, says Dominic Bryan, a reader in social anthropology at Queen's University Belfast.
It's hyped up because when they go through nationalist areas, there's often people protesting, there's people shouting at them, so you create this environment. That said, I watched them take paramilitary flags through. They've taken banners through of paramilitary people in loyalist paramilitaries.
Dominic says that the Irish Nationalist Party in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin, have been responsible for some of the negative hype around the flute bands, but that they are in no way completely responsible.
If you think it's just Sinn Féin, then you're not understanding the experience of nationalists and Catholics in Belfast and other places who do get to experience loyalism in a very real and very threatening way. It's loyalists that do that. So it's very difficult to say that nationalists don't have any reason to have any fears if you watch about that behaviour.
And there's a pig with a flag on a bonfire.
In a small wasteland, surrounded by bushes and trees and a housing estate, a group of boys and girls scramble up a huge tower of wooden pallets, topped off with tyres. They proudly place three green, white and orange flags on top of the structure. At midnight, young men pour petrol on the pyre and set it alight. The tricolour flag of the Republic of Ireland burns as members of the community watch, chat and dance with drinks in hand. The kids draped in Union Jack flags and wearing red, white and blue face paint run around excitedly. Protestant communities across Northern Ireland light bonfires on the evening of the 11th of July to commemorate the arrival of King William in Ireland. On bonfires in other areas, effigies of the Pope and other Catholic and nationalist symbols burn alongside the flag. Not everyone on this estate agrees with the practice.
It's what the men do, you know. Unfortunately, that's out of our control. We just fundraise and that's it, you know. That's nothing to do with me, or I can't control that. Certainly wouldn't listen to me if I said I'd rather you didn't do that, you know. But it's just it, you know.
Kellyanne McCoubrey is 35 and has three small children. She grew up in the small, mainly Protestant housing estate in impoverished, working-class North Belfast. Kellyanne has been fundraising for the party throughout the year.
It's my culture, you know. I don't have any kind of hatred for Catholics, or it's not about that, you know. It's about the culture that I've grew up in, and I don't hate anybody because they're a Catholic. I'm just celebrating my culture, you know, and that's it.
Still, Catholic and nationalist communities stay away from the bonfires and the parades the next day. Many leave Northern Ireland for the Republic during the July 12th celebrations. They feel intimidated and unwelcome in Belfast and elsewhere. Families with children wrapped in Union Jack flags line Donegal Place, one of Belfast's main shopping streets. They cheer and smile as men dressed in military uniforms march along the road, the sound of flutes and drums filling the air. Barely half a mile away, the flute tunes can just about be heard on the wind. A father rushes his three children beyond the walls of the Carrick estate onto the main road. Not far into the mainly Catholic estate, a man wearing shorts and a T-shirt in the warm sun waters his plants.
Up until 3 years ago, it was pandemonium around here.
Frank Dempsey has lived in this area for more than four decades. Parade season here was often marked with protests by nationalists who opposed the marches, particularly those passing through Catholic-majority areas, like this one. It often led to violence and riots. But Frank says things have changed, here at least.
People of this area just had a request to be a bit of respect. They wanted no music from a certain stretch of the road, short stretch, and no supporters. And for the past 3 years it's been like that. And this area has changed dramatically since it. It's quieting down, you've walked about the area, there's nobody standing out there protesting. The bands are going by, just no music, no supporters. So it's happy times here.
Still, it's a fragile understanding. Unionists insist marching is an important part of their culture. Over the years, they've been prevented from marching along traditional but contentious routes that border nationalist parts of the city, or even go right through them.
They've got their own culture. They're entitled to celebrate their own culture. But what they're not entitled to, they're not entitled to ram it down our throats. And they're certainly not entitled to think that we're second-class citizens. It has to be a shared city. It has to be a shared future. And it's about time we start to realise this isn't 1690. It's long gone out there.
Divisions clearly still remain between the two communities. But there are those hoping the resentment won't go on with their children. But as long as tensions continue to simmer below the surface, the fear of violence lingers on.
Louise Osborne with that report, which was also compiled by Jennifer Collins. And that's it for today. The programme is produced with help from Helen Sini. The sound technician is Gert Georgi, and I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on SoundCloud and iTunes. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW in Bonn.